in states like California, who she calls weak on crime.
We need to make sure that we are supporting the police officers and the first responders in all of our cities to make sure that citizens and businesses feel like they can operate and live safely.
But California Delegate Marjorie Prophet says she loves her state, and that's why she's fighting to help with its homeless population.
The majority of them have mental health problems, and with mental health problems come safety issues. And to find them a place to get help, rehabilitate them, find them jobs, meaningful work, will make a meaningful citizen.
I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
This is KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today. And this is what feminism can sound like. As we all endure the latest decisions of the Supreme Court, it can feel like long ago history that Christine Blasey Ford told us about the real Brett Kavanaugh in her testimony during his confirmation hearings. And the hashtag MeToo movement seems to have faded from memory in some ways. But Ford's new memoir, One Way Back, is a powerful reminder of the price she paid for speaking out. And writer and feminist Moira Donegan wrote a brilliant and thoughtful review of it in Book Forum. Moira is also a columnist for The Guardian, and it's so great to have her with us now to talk about this. So welcome to Feminist Magazine, Moira.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you start the review off reminding us about the sort of, quote, triumphalist historicizing, how the liberal feminist movement really remembers Me Too. How did that all come about?
Yeah, so I think at the time when Me Too was unfolding in late 2017, and early 2018, there was a tendency, and I think it was a really understandable one, to celebrate the courage of the women coming forward, right? To sort of almost exhale with this relief that finally this information that had been kept, not exactly secret in many cases, but beneath the threshold of broad public understanding, was being brought to the fore and reckoned with as morally significant, right? So a lot of people sort of knew what Harvey Weinstein was doing to women who worked for him or would have liked to in Hollywood. A lot of people sort of knew what Louis C.K. was doing to women comedians. There had been jokes about Bill Cosby's penchant for drugging and sexually assaulting women in his orbit for many years, you know. So it was not that this was exactly silent, but it was that it had not come to be significant in the public assessments of these men's character, right? And that effort to make it significant that Me Too represented was a real victory for feminist consciousness raising and a genuine success, at least for some time, of this sort of persuasive effort on the part of really hundreds and thousands of individual feminists coming together to say, no, sexual violence matters. Sexual harassment matters. The safety and dignity of women and others matters. And that is, in I think a lot of our historical reckonings of Me Too, when we look back on the movement, that's sort of where the story ends, right? A bunch of famous men sort of were embarrassed. A few of them lost their jobs. A very small number faced criminal prosecutions. And then we sort of looked away, and the question of feminist encounters with sexual violence has really receded, especially in light of the Dobbs decision and sort of the civil rights and public health emergency that has been presented now by abortion bans. So you have fewer people sort of thinking about sexual violence. And I think you really have fewer people thinking about what the aftermath of those disclosures and of that moment was for the women who disclosed their own experiences and were sort of tasked with telling the truth about these men and with trying to make that truth matter. And that's where I think Christine Blasey Ford's memoir, which came out earlier this year, could be a really interesting intervention. And that's what I tried to approach in the book forum piece.
Right. And the line in your review that really hit me was, "One Way Back," the title of the book, is the artifact of a devastated life. And that was, you know, gut punch line. So you take apart how she wrote it and why she wrote it at this time, right?
Yeah. So I want to be very clear that I did not read One Way Back as like a complaint book. I did not read it as a self-pitying book. I think Blasey Ford is a figure who's very familiar to many of us. She's a vividly ordinary person who's launched into these extraordinary circumstances, and really not of her own choosing, right? This was very much something that happened to her. She was all but forced to testify. And in the aftermath of that testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee in September 2018, you know, her life changed irrevocably in ways she did not and would not have chosen, right? And in many ways, her life became smaller. And there are some of these that are very concrete examples of how her life was hurt by her testimony and by the experience of having been a public survivor, right? So for one thing, she got a lot of death threats, many of which were very credible. She continues to receive death threats. She could not go to her home in California for the better part of a year. She was staying in various hotels and at the houses of community members. You know, she was reliant on charity because she was not safe. That is a devastating experience that was both financially and psychically draining. And, you know, she had to hire full-time security for many months for herself, for her husband, and for her two sons because they were in danger and because they needed protection from violence. She still has to employ the services of a security firm, which assesses threats and surveils threats to her. She had to make improvements to her home so that when she could go back, it would be safe for her. And these are all, you know, very, very expensive. You know, Blasey Ford is a fixture in her community in Palo Alto, near where I teach at Stanford University. She also teaches at Stanford Medical School. And it's a place where she was proximate socially and just physically to a lot of rich people, right? And they were able to take care of her. And so in some ways, she's fortunate, right? On the other hand, why did she need that charity in the first place? Because we live in a society that so punishes women who come forward about sexual abuse. So that's the material matter. That's the matter of money and physical violence, right? But I also want to really dwell on the psychic cost that survivors have to endure when they come forward in public. And I think Ford does a really wonderful job of writing through something that is kind of unspeakable, this robbery of identity that happened to her when she came into the public eye, right? She will never be known by anything except this man who hurt her. For the vast majority of people who will ever hear her name, that is what she is. It's one of the probably, let's hope, worst things that has happened to her, right? It happened to her a very long time ago, before she had the experiences and the accomplishments that made her the person she understands herself to be, right? She cannot make herself understood as Christine, right? She is Christine Blasey Ford in the public imagination, right? So she has to be haunted by this other version of herself that exists in the minds of others, that exists in the media, that exists in history, that might not, in fact, really, in fact, we know it doesn't because she told us, it might not and does not reflect how she sees herself and who she wants to be. There's so much more that happens in a survivor's life beyond abuse. And I don't say that to minimize abuse. I say that to credit the expansiveness of women's personhood, right? There is a lot that we don't just survive, we survive to do all these other things. We survive to become all these other things and to live these bigger lives. And it is kind of a perverse victory for the abuser that when women come forward, his actions are allowed to control and to dictate her identity. And that's a real psychic pain, right? She does not get to, there's a really kind of devastating conversation that she has in the book. It's like very close to her testimony. It's the weeks or month afterward, and she's on the phone with a representative from a PR firm that has been hired on her behalf. And she's talking to this PR rep, and she's saying, it's, you know, she's saying something to the effect of this figure that is appearing in the news, in the cruel, you know, caricatures deployed by Republican senators, this figure that's being laughed about in right-wing media and on the, you know, the vast cruelty of the internet. That person doesn't even look like me. Like, that person has no resemblance to me. And I want to correct the public record about myself, about my identity. And the PR person tells her not just not to, but that she can't. She says, you will never be anything other than what you were on that day. And I want to just, like, slow down and dwell upon the profound psychic violence of that awareness, that you can't be anything other than a representative of sexual abuse and its psychic cost. That's a robbery of not just the time, not just all the money she had to spend, not just the humiliation of putting herself out there in this very painful, public, humiliating ordeal and having it not ultimately matter. But that's a robbery of her very sense of self, right? And I think this is something about the experience of coming forward publicly that Me Too, in its triumphalist historicism, in that sense of like, okay, we did it, girls. it's over now. We've solved sexual violence because you're so brave. That's not, I think, a well-intentioned or cynical look at Me Too historically, but it's an incomplete one, right? It doesn't account for what it costs these women who do come forward, both in terms of how they are made to pay expense and how they are sort of limited in who they can be after making that sort of disclosure.
Right. And she writes that she's not haunted by the sexual assault because she doesn't even repeat the details of it particularly. She tells readers to essentially Google it, so that the central catastrophe is what happened to her when she talked about it. And she became our symbolic representative, but then a scapegoat.
Right. She became a symbolic representative of Me Too, of the courage and difficulty of the determination, right? Which is kind of a pedestal placing that feels a little alien to her. She makes it clear she didn't particularly feel brave. She didn't make a choice to come forward. This was something that sort of happened to her. Other people really sort of made these choices. But then she also becomes a figure in the right-wing imagination that is a very legitimate target for mockery, for demonization, for trivialization, and becomes a way, like almost a prism through which the right wing can direct all of its anger at Me Too through this one woman who, you know, told the truth. That's all she did.
Right. And she was such a credible, you know, quote unquote witness, because she used her own training in psychology to talk about how the brain holds memory. And there was this moment, as you wrote, when we're watching the testimony, we're checking our updates on Twitter. We still believed in Twitter in those days. And we're all like, oh, this is, you know, the moral higher ground is ours in this moment. And yet it wasn't.
Yeah, you know, the audience's role is really vexed and interesting, right? I love that you mentioned that point, how she used the terminology from psychology, which is her academic background and her profession. She's a professor of psychological statistics. That's what she studies. It's very specialized. But she did have this recourse to a vocabulary of the functioning of the brain, right? So when she was grilled in my opinion, quite cynical way, by the senators on that committee about her own credibility and about these epistemic questions that sort of haunt every survivor of sexual assault that comes forward. How do you remember? How do you know it was him? how are you sure that he knew you didn't want it, right? How are you sure that you have recovered this accurately from the time? And she was able to counter, not with what most people, most survivors who are not experts in this, are able to counter with, which is, of course I know. Of course I remember. Of course he knew I didn't want it. He put his hand over my mouth to stop me screaming, which is something that Brett Kavanaugh did to her in her account. She was able to actually draw on the recourse of her particular training and talk about the mechanisms of the brain and of how memory formation happens, both in normal circumstances and in traumatic events, right? And that was, I think, a moment of triumph for Ford, because it was something where the particulars of her personality and her individuality were able to bust through the constraints of type, right? She was not merely a victim of either Brett Kavanaugh or of the Senate Judiciary Committee in that moment. She was actually an expert in her field, right? And that was something that is not a recourse that all survivors has. That's something that Christine had, you know? And I am really appreciative of that moment and of the fact that she drew on her particular individuality for it. But also, I do think you bring up this other sort of ethical question, or really maybe more of a moral question, which is that of witness and where our role as spectators merges between witness and voyeurism, right? And I think that's actually a very ambivalent line, even for those of us who identify as feminists, even for those of us who are survivors, because there is a way in which how Me Too played out in the media, in events like Dr. Ford's testimony, but not exclusive to it, became not only a source of moral edification, it also did become entertainment, right? Especially in these very high-profile cases that featured celebrities and powerful men, in some cases powerful women, as perpetrators and victims. You know, there was a sense of almost titillation in some of these media accounts, right? And it was easy for a voyeuristic impulse in that moment to come sort of smuggled in under the guise of a moral reckoning, right? And I think there was a genuine simultaneity. I'm not saying, or I'm not trying to say, that Me Too was actually all about, you know, pornographic fascination with sexual violence as sexual, you know, titillation, right? That's not all that was, sincerely not all that was going on. So it's not like, you know, the end of Scooby-Doo where the kids pull off the mask and it turns out to have been the innkeeper the whole time. It was a genuine mix of motives that were happening in that reckoning, where at once we could, as women, as survivors, empathize with the likes of Angelina Jolie, and at the same time, we could have a little bit of satisfaction about being let behind the curtain, you know, about being allowed to see these concealed or suppressed truths about our world and about how sex really functions to distribute power and to deprive people of it. And I think that was something that did not always resolve in ways that we might find flattering, you know, because in the aftermath of Me Too, what people remember more is salacious details. What they don't remember as much, and I include myself in this indictment, they don't remember as much the lessons about taking seriously this issue. They don't remember as much the lessons about double-checking if your impulse to defend men who you know who are close to you might be colored by misogyny. They don't take seriously, or they don't remember as well, the lessons about really reckoning with your own past and your own behavior, and the ways in which you might have hurt others or helped somebody else to hurt others. And they don't really take seriously, I think, Me Too's indictment of what has been considered normal, right? I think it's very easy now to look back on Me Too and say, well, you know, Harvey Weinstein was really extreme. And the fact of the matter is that Harvey Weinstein's not that extreme. There are men who extort sex in exchange for professional favors or opportunity in basically every industry, right? And it might not look as glamorous. It might not be actresses in hotels, But that dynamic is something that is very normal, right? It's very pervasive. And just because it's very normal, I think we can forget, does not mean that it is not, in fact, horrific, right? Just because these are experiences that most women have had in some form or another, and that, you know, God knows many trans and non-binary people have also had in some form of another, does not mean that their commonality should detract from their awfulness. A lot of very normal things are, in fact, really devastating and really wrong. And that's something that I think we've gotten sort of accustomed to forgetting, or that we've maybe lost a little bit of sight of in the years that have passed.
I think it was interesting earlier you mentioned that there was a sort of consciousness raising aspect to this. And then also that it was called the Me Too movement. And I was always interested to sort of look at it and be, it wasn't a movement in the sense of a sort of political movement that built, that expanded where many took action. It's sort of like the energy started, and then sort of in my sense of a movement of second wave feminism, the way that a movement was built, or any other, the union movement, where in a sense many all came together. It was like we put forward individuals, and that it was almost easier then to knock them down. And perhaps it was a function of how much we were playing this all out in the media rather than having built something that we all came forward together in a way.
Yeah, you're right that Me Too did not really yield organizing as such. Mm-hmm. It didn't really produce institutions. There's Tarana Burke's Me Too Foundation, which is wonderful work. There was briefly Time's Up, which sort of collapsed under its own proximity to power and the complicity of some of its leadership. But, you know, there was not movement building, right? And I think that you're right to point out that this is not unique to feminism. This is like sort of a product of our age in which IRL organizing is very, very difficult. Hashtag activism, medium narratives are a lot easier and more accessible, and people sort of clutch on to symbolism and to points that can be made through media events, maybe more easily than they, you know, reach out to people they know in real life and help to, you know, provide a support to those who need it, hold accountable those who should be held accountable. And that's something that is, you know, a movement-wide issue on the American left that I don't think we're going to solve on this podcast. No.
Wish we could.
Right to point it out, right?
Yeah.
Because I love your point about these symbolic representatives that were made out of individual stories, right? Mm. Because then if any individual accuser or storyteller is vulnerable in some way, as all human beings are, their flaws can be made into symbols of movement flaws, just the way their suffering was made into symbols of, you know, gender-wide or social-wide suffering.
Exactly.
And that's, you know, a genuine flaw in media-based activism. It is much easier to knock down somebody like Christine Blasey Ford, who is one survivor from California, who has the full range of human virtues and flaws, than it is to knock down a real organization and a movement and a network of institutionalized mm-hmm. solidarity that could stand behind somebody like that.
Yeah.
And it was a, I think, a bit of a missed opportunity, but I don't really have anybody to blame. You know, I think people were, those of us who were survivors were in a lot of pain. We were scared, you know, for good reason. We saw what happened to Christine Blasey Ford. We had seen what happened to survivors who came forward before. And there was not evidenced in that brief hot Me Too moment of a lot of opportunities, right?
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like, you know, there was a tremendous amount of energy and outrage and sort of collective willingness to take this seriously and to sort of countenance the hurt that sexual violence causes. But there were also immediately backlash, dissenters. And so I was in a position where I was looking around my industry and I saw a lot of young women and other people who were sort of suffering the way I was suffering and were scared and angry the way I was scared and angry. But also in every one of them was a potential betrayer. somebody who could rat you out to management, somebody who could tell your assaulter so that he could retaliate or sue you. You know, there was tremendous potential that was tempered by tremendous danger. So I think it's, you know, like everything else, it's a human failure. It was a failure of organizing, a movement failure that came from very human, very understandable vulnerabilities. I get why it happened. And we just have to learn for next time.
Exactly. Building the solidarity first, using the media as like the icing on the cake. And what I also found really interesting in your review was this idea that it was sort of the moral wrong, that instead of saying that it was an insult to women that men who, you know, who rape and beat us are elevated to power, Christine Blasey Ford actually thought it was an insult or that power is something that's virtuous and noble, as you said, and that it demeaned the office. She genuinely had this belief that others would believe that too, that others would see that too. And now we're looking sort of at the Supreme Court right now, which is losing all credibility. She genuinely believed that, you know, she could, if she spoke clearly, something could change. She had like written to her congressperson. She had this, was it an idealism? Was it a naivete?
You know, people talk about Ford as naive a lot. Mm. And I think she came to that Senate hearing room with, you know, the virtue of honesty and with what I would consider the virtue, which is of, you know, conviction of the wrongness of sexual violence, right? A lot of people don't have that conviction. And she was seen as sort of not appropriately apprehending the cynicism of the world that she was entering when she flew into Washington and sat down in that hearing room, right? And I think that's one way to look at it, right? You can think of her as sort of a naive dupe who was a little too optimistic about our form of government and about the people who populate it. But I also wanted to think about Christine Blasey Ford as somebody who had willingly rejected that world, right? Because she grew up in D.C. She grew up around the children of politicians and diplomats. You know, her dad was a powerful military type. She went to a very fancy elite prep school for girls in the D.C. suburbs called Holton Arms. You know, Kavanaugh, she hung out with Brett Kavanaugh, whose mother was a powerful judge in Maryland. You know, she was of that world when she grew up, and she hated it. And she hated, in part, its cynicism, its ambition, its privileging of ambition over morality. That's why she left. That's why she went to California and became a surfer. You know, she was in part disillusioned with that world. So she came back to DC, not just to tell the truth, right? But to tell the truth to a world, to people inhabiting a way of life, to people perched atop these structures of power that I think she understood quite well, right? So in one sense, you can see her as somebody who had too much faith in virtue, who thought that sexism mattered morally more than it did. But you can also see her as somebody who held fast to her own principles about how telling the truth was the right thing to do, about how sexual violence is wrong, even in the face of a really corrupt institution, right? So I think, you know, it's definitely a failure of those institutions, right? It's definitely a sign that their own purported claims to virtue and authority and seriousness, you know, are not sincere. That are, right. Their claims to virtue look laughable in the face of what Christine Blasey Ford did. But I think that reflects well on her and badly on them. And, you know, who would want to be cynical enough and corrupt enough to maneuver successfully among those people? Mm-hmm. I don't.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you talk about Me Too was supposed to be, you know, a reckoning, right? A moral revolution. But instead, you write that instead of honoring the sacrifice of the truth tellers, it became this plundering of public survivors' psyches. So you don't think it was worth it, but she wrote this book because of all the letters, right, that she received. She took a number of years to get there, and I completely understand that. And there's this photograph of her with these boxes and boxes of letters from supporters. And that was what impelled her to write the book. How do you sort of put those two together?
Yeah, you know, I sent her a letter. I think a lot of people did. I know a lot of people did. And it's interesting because she's got this relationship that transcends, you know, herself, not just with her own past experience of sexual abuse, which is now what she is a symbol of in the public mm-hmm. imagination, but with all these other experiences of sexual abuse, right? She has become a symbol not only of that historical moment and of sort of the unworthiness of the Senate and the court, but she's also become a symbol of persistence and courage, right? And I think she seems to feel somewhat ambivalent about that. You know, she paid this price and acted as kind of a sacrificial lamb for the principle of sexual abuse's wrongness, right? And she, you know, sees herself as having a great moral obligation to the people who wrote in and who experienced that, right? And that is an obligation that can instill a lot of hope and principle. And it can also be a burden. You know, I think it's supposed to be, I think we have to be honest about what the role of being that kind of public figure can do to you. And, you know, this is a really heavy moral load to carry. It is both a privilege and a burden. I think it has, we have to understand it as both in order to really understand what she did and to honor her at her sacrifice efficiently.
Wow. Well, we've been talking to writer Moira Donegan about the memoir by Christine Blasey Ford. It's called One Way Back, which is also a telling title. And Moira, thank you so much for joining us to kind of unravel all the many threads and bring your really thoughtful analysis to this. And thanks for joining us on Feminist Magazine today.
Thank you, Lynn. It was an honor to be here.
Support comes from a celebration of folk music, August 17th and 18th, live at the Greek Theater. Performing artists include folk music's early pioneers, the Kingston Trio, and the Limelighters, with additional performances by the Hotlicks, the music of Dan Hicks, the John Stewart Band, plus special guest renowned tenor banjo player Cynthia Sayer. For more information and tickets, visit GreekTheater.com or KPFK.org. Boy, you're bound to die.
Power to the people! KPFK Los Angeles, a progressive media outlet, challenging corporate media perspectives with spirited political debate, local news, public affairs, health and wellness, music, and the arts. Listener-supported, non-commercial community radio, serving the cultural welfare of all races, creeds, and colors. 90.7 KPFK. Power to the people. Right on.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And coming up next...
So reproductive justice is an expansive and revolutionary vision.
In the shadow of debate over elective abortion, we sat down with Dr. Alexis Pauline Gumbs to talk about a vision for the future that reaches deep into existing wisdom around care and caregiving. It starts with reading folks like June Jordan and Alice Walker.
She says, mothering is an instinct, yes, but it's also a skill that can be taught. And she believed that everyone should learn the skills associated with mothering because that's what we all need in order to actually shift into a life-giving, sustaining relationship to community, planet, life itself.
Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, DIV abortion is only one piece of a larger conversation about reproduction. The reproductive justice movement started in the mid-1990s by Black and Indigenous women argues, rarely do we find ourselves fighting for just one aspect of reproductive justice, such as abortion rights. We sat down with a daughter of the movement, Dr. Alexis Pauline Gums, to talk about a vision for the path forward. Alexis Pauline Gums is a queer Black troublemaker and Black feminist love evangelist, founder or the co-founder of several community organizations focused on everything from ending gendered violence to land trust to healing work and all things media. She's a writer with work published in several outlets, 5 books already born and 1 in gestation called The Eternal Life of Audre Lorde. Alexis is a teacher, making access to regular folks a priority. She founded Brilliance Remastered, an online network and series of retreats and online intensives serving community accountable intellectuals and artists. I have to ask, does this mean our listeners?
Yes.
Okay, great. So it's very exciting. It seems that the uniting theme of all of her work is a passion for the issues that impact oppressed communities and an intimate knowledge of the resilience of movements led by Black, Indigenous, working class women and queer people of color. Today, we're going to be talking about the book, one of your books, one of your babies that you co-edited with China Martins and Maya Williams. This book is really very truly dear to me. Like, it's my friend. And the book is Revolutionary Mothering, Love on the Front Lines. And if it's okay, I wanted to read some praise from Alice Walker.
Oh, I love that.
Revolutionary Mothering, Love on the Front Lines is juicy, gutsy, vulnerable, and very brave. These women insist on having their children in a society that does not welcome them, in a world that is rapidly falling apart. Their dream for their children, based on their love of them, encompasses the sorrow and the joy that mothers everywhere, whether human, animal, or plant, feel at this time, a radical vision, many radical visions of how I'm to mother in a time of resistance and of pain. There's a beautiful preface in the book by Professor Loretta Ross that it gives it a sort of a rich, almost like sensorial context to the formation of the reproductive justice movement. And in a minute, I am going to ask you to tell me the birth story of the book. But first, I was wondering if you could tell me and our listeners the birth story of the reproductive justice movement.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, so the reason that we are so honored that Loretta Ross could have agreed to write a preface for Revolutionary Mothering is that we definitely know that that work wouldn't have been possible for us, imaginable even outside of the context of a reproductive justice movement. And Loretta Ross is one of the founding mothers of that movement. So reproductive justice is an expansive and revolutionary vision that is about really empowering all of us, but especially the people most impacted by multiple systems of oppression, to have autonomy over what happens with our capacity to create, what happens in terms of our ability to define and create the relationships that we have, the families that we want, the destinies that we want for our own bodies. And its expansiveness is in some way the response of feminists of color, including Loretta Ross, to what they saw as some of the limitations to the idea of reproductive rights, in quotes. And so they wanted to create something that really spoke to the multiple ways that our capacity as beings that are part of a species that can proliferate, that needs each other to survive, that lives and relates in units of community, beyond the question of access to abortion or not access to abortion. And also that takes into account the histories of coerced sterilization. It takes into account histories of experimentation with birth control drugs on impoverished women in Puerto Rico, all of these different truth-telling
imperatives are part of what makes the reproductive justice movement exist.
I love an intellectual. I have to tell you that. I mean, you know, I'm a nurse, and I don't know if you know other nurses, but, you know, we are very, like, of the earth. And so, like, it is so stimulating to talk to somebody who's kind of the clouds, you know what I mean? Like, in a most, sure. in a lovely way, because I'm thinking, tell me the birth story, and I'm thinking, it was 1994, and these women gathered in Chicago, and they ate at Chipotle, or, you know, and then, right, they went back to the South. And they formed Sister Song, right?
Yes. Also, there's a really important essay in an anthology called The Color of Violence that Insight Women of Color Against Violence published, where Loretta Ross writes her definition of reproductive justice, which I would refer everyone to, because that is for me, that's the best way to hear that origin story, aside from if you're very blessed and get to just listen to Loretta Ross or Billy Avery themselves. So there's Sister Song was really the space to say, like, to sing what reproductive justice is and to roll that out into the world. And Loretta Ross was the founding executive director of Sister Song. Mm. And the Sister Song conferences, the Let's Talk About Sex conferences, became this catalyzing movement space. One of the things that they did that I love is that they had mother-daughter fellowships to go to the conference. And so my mother and I went to Sister Song in Chicago.
That is so beautiful. Together.
I think that at the core of reproductive justice is, and I've heard Loretta Ross recently talk about this as like a reproductive futurity, is that it is intergenerational. It lives in intergenerationality. And they have moved that way the entire time. So in Atlanta, there's a place called Mother House. And this was it's really a house. It was the headquarters for Black Women's Health Project. And just to give a corner to the story, which really probably only I can tell you, when I was a teenage writer growing up in Atlanta, I went to Mother House to the basement to lead a writing workshop and facilitate the creation of a newsletter, like a newsletter about sex for the teenagers. And I was a teenager. They were like children who were part of the summer program that Black Women's Health Project had as part of its initiative for there to be intergenerational conversations about sex and profoundly comprehensive sex education. And so that was actually the first time that as a writer facilitator, I ever was paid to facilitate a writing workshop, which to me keys into this idea of reproductive justice movement generating our creativity in all these multiple ways, right? And then the children, who many of them were children of these same reproductive justice movement workers, just were having these incredible conversations about sexuality and gender and fluidity and justice and autonomy and consent, like all of these things. And so it was a blessing to be able to have an intergenerational view on that from a young age.
It's so cool that you had such a front row seat.
Yeah.
And like how neat that it really ties into the book, I feel like, because a lot of the book that you co-edited is talking about the actual work of mothering as revolutionary work itself. And so this idea that your mother was taking you to these places, she was raising a revolutionary. I mean, look at you now, you know, like she did the work, you know, and now look at you like putting it out into the world in even bigger, further ways. What's the birth story of this book?
Oh, yay. Okay. So it goes back to a internet love story. My would-be future co-editor, Maya, and I met on the internet. And I think we both have been making zines for a long time. We blog, and I think we found each other that way. And Maya was wanting to use a workbook I had made with these women in South Africa who had taken over an abandoned factory to create their own school with their children. And I was like, what? Who is this person? You know, I was like, this is what you do. So Maya is an international human rights worker and journalist. And she, while we were cultivating our friendship, she was traveling all over the world and she was organizing with mothers. She was organizing with moms who were part of the Zapatista movement. She was organizing with moms who were part of the Arab Spring uprising. She was organizing in Palestine. And in all of these spaces, she was telling me what was going on and the revolution.
She was finding the moms.
She was finding the moms. Yeah. And she already had a really clear understanding that that is revolutionary. And then she started to create this zine called Revolutionary Motherhood. Meanwhile, I am in the archive researching. I'm working on my PhD and my dissertation is called We Can Learn to Mother Ourselves, The Queer Survival of Black Feminism. And so I'm looking at everything that these feminists of color are saying about mothering in the 1980s, 1970s and 1980s. And so I'm looking through Audre Lorde's papers. I'm looking through June Jordan's papers. I'm looking through finding these Azalea and the Salsa Soul Sister Gazette and, you know, all of these out of print publications that are basically ancestors to our zines that we're creating. And I'm telling her what I find, right? And so she's like, listen to what happened in Gaza. And I'm like, listen to what June Jordan said in 1977, you know? And at some point we were like, okay, this conversation that we're having is actually a real conversation. Like we are meant to put together this archive and legacy of a revolutionary approach to mothering and contemporary people who are living this and practicing it right now. So we should create an anthology. This is our idea. And then we met China Martins, who's our would-be co-editor, at the Allied Media Conference. And China's like almost a generation older than Maya and I. Maya and I are pretty close in age. And China is like zine's forerunner. Like she was the first person to write mothering zines about being a mother, about raising a kid on welfare. She was really the first. And The Future Generation is the name of her zine. And so we were like, yes, you know, like this is our trifecta dream team. At the beginning, we thought we were going to call it This Bridge Called My Baby. And when we sent out our call for submissions, that's what we said. And we're creating an anthology called This Bridge Called My Baby. And, you know, so many people sent in essays and poems and stories. And we were like, whoa, this is amazing. And we started this process of the intensive work of creating an anthology. And it took like 7 years before it actually existed in print. Anyway, so the reason that we created this book was because we really felt that there was something to be said about, again, intergenerationally, what it means to really just shine light on a revolutionary approach to mothering, right? Because we're very clear, like, we're not creating that. It's something very, very old.
Mm-hmm.
It's really important to us that, we were like over the moon, ready to pass out when Alice Walker wrote that blurb, because her idea of democratic motherism, it talks about mothering as a form of being in the world and really as the ethical form of being in the world, and that it can include everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a line in that essay where she says, mothering is an instinct, yes, but it's also a skill. It can be taught. And she believes that everyone should learn the skills associated with mothering, because that's what we all need in order to actually shift into a life-giving, sustaining relationship to community, planet, life itself. And so the deepest thing that we wanted recognition for all of this revolutionary labor that we're naming as revolutionary mothering, that has been happening for generations and without which certainly the three of us wouldn't exist as who we are, or maybe at all. And it's possible to think that maybe life wouldn't exist, right? There are these constant acts of life-giving and care that are transformative and revolutionary because they exist right up against these forms of repression that have seemingly done everything to eradicate them.
Wow, that's quite a birth story.
Yes, thank you for asking.
Well, I have to tell you, like, the reason why I reached out to you recently about doing this interview and talking about this book that was published in 2016. You know, it's not like there's like a timely stamp on this or whatever, right. Except that there is.
Right.
Because I have to tell you, I was raised in central Indiana by lesbian pastors. I have this tendency that I think is residual from my raising that is during times of stress or confusion, like to go to text. Protestants love their Bible study. So I don't really turn to the Bible, but I go to my bookshelf. And I feel like all of our different states and communities are pretty much trying to decide who they are.
Yeah.
I mean, I have not heard the word abortion so much ever in my life before being discussed openly.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to know, are there other things that you think people could be reading right now as they're kind of grappling with whatever is happening in their communities?
I mean, of course, people we've mentioned, right? Alice Walker is somebody who to always read, but I would say especially her essay. When we think about abortion, she's somebody who's been very open about the fact that this is a part of her experience and her early politicization as a young woman, a young college student, and she has this expansive perspective that I draw on over and over again. So read more Alice Walker. June Jordan, definitely. And I'll just say the essay that we were so honored to print in Revolutionary Mothering is called The Creative Spirit in Children's Literature. And this is the place where June Jordan makes the proclamation that love is life force. And this is a talk that she gave at a conference about children's literature at Berkeley in California in 1977. And the first sentence is just, love is life force. That's it. The end. Like, that's everything right there. And she goes on to offer this incredible, expansive definition of what creativity is, what creation is, and how it exists within all species. And then she talks about the accountability of what our intergenerational conversation is, right? So what's at stake in children's literature for June Jordan is, what is the possible conversation we can have between generations? And she just goes deep into, like, what is it? What are the fears that brings up in adults? What's disrespectful about not talking about certain things with young people?
And before we get away from it, I do want to, if it's okay, I want to read like just a very short piece from this essay that you're making reference to, if it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
June Jordan says, "And it seems to me that love, that is serious and tender concern to respect the nature and the spontaneous purpose of other things, other people, will make manifest a peaceable order among us, such that fear, conflict, competition, waste, and environmental sacrifice will have no place." That passage means a lot. It's like, that's everything. Like, what else is there
to say? That's everything, like you said, right? It's everything that we need. Like, we would do this one thing.
Yeah.
We would do this
thing. We could just, like, live like this. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that I can never get too much of June Jordan. So I turn to so many. I turn to Angela Davis. I turn to my dear sister, Adrienne Marie Brown. I turn to Walida E. Marisha. I turn, of course, to Loretta Ross. So I'm a creative writing editor at the Journal of Feminist Studies. And there's a resource on the Feminist Studies website that, in response to the Supreme Court decision, that we decided to create, and it kind of chronicles, because this is an issue that is in the journal all the time. but it chronicles an archive going back, it's 50 years that this journal has existed. You could look at that to give kind of a long view of how feminist thinkers have been writing about this over time. There's so much reading to do.
We're jumping in to remind you that you are listening to Making Contact and an interview with Dr. Alexis Pauline Gumbs. Visit us online at radioproject.org, where you can join the conversation with a comment. And now back to the show. And we've talked about reading. We've talked about holding workshops. Is there anything else that you're doing to find hope right now, or kind of manage yourself and your community?
Yeah, I think the other things on a smaller scale has just been more reaching out. You know, like I have kind of had to get over it. And even me being like, oh, nobody wants to really hear from me, or, oh, I can't, you know, like, let me stay within the boundary of not reaching out even to people I do know, or like my own friends, you know, like that's been a thing that I've struggled with. And now I see, I'm like, oh, that's complicit in the forms of isolation that those who would harm all of us want to exist so that we don't acknowledge our collective power, right? And act accordingly. And so that's definitely been a way. I am not a nurse, but I'm like a major distributor of just raspberry leaf to people, you know, like, it's just, yes. I'm like, this will help. You know, I have my little peppermint raspberry leaf.
Your tinctures and your witchy
the tea,
brews.
You know, all of that. And and also just that practice for myself, you know, I mean, it's tied to what Loretta Ross is talking about, this legacy of us taking care of ourselves and each other and learning what that takes in relationship with the natural world.
Taking care of yourself is revolution. Taking care of your children is revolution. As a mom of human babies, it doesn't always feel that way. It is work that is unseen and unappreciated by capitalism completely. And so it, you know, to all you moms out there, keep your head up like you're doing it.
Yes.
And to all the people who are doing mothering work that isn't to human babies, it's important work too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that our dream for revolutionary mothering includes. It's to say that the exact isolation that you're talking about, where capitalism pretends to not value the labor of mothering, but it needs it.
It needs it. It requires it, doesn't it?
Right.
Doesn't it?
That is what we want to shine a light on. All of those acts of care, the disgusting, you know, if someone's spitting up on you, you know, all those things are happening. Those have such revolutionary potential. And what would a world be like where we valued that in such a way that the actual labor of it wasn't isolated either, right? And that is, in fact, dangerous to capitalism. It's certainly dangerous to any system that would want to disempower anyone, but particularly disempower women, because, there's too much love. There's too much love and creativity. And when we collaborate on it,
that's some powerful stuff.
That's it. Love is life force.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
yeah. So thank you so much for having me.
I've been your host, Amy Gastelum.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. And thanks to all of the contributors today, especially to Making Contact Radio. Feminist Magazine is produced by a coalition of feminist volunteers. You can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook and on Instagram, or just email us at feministmagazine@yahoo.com. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from the Peacock Theater in downtown L.A., presenting Mel Brooks, Saturday, July 27th at 7:30 p.m. for a celebration of the 50th anniversary of his iconic comedy classic, Blazing Saddles.